This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. The journalist Paul Tough has spent a lot of time thinking and writing about education and child development. His new book is his fourth, and this time he's focused on the country's system of higher education. He begins the book with the story of Shannon Torres. She was a senior at a high school in New York City in a rough neighborhood, West Harlem. And Tough had agreed to meet up with Shannon. He didn't know it then, but it was a big day for her, like the biggest.
We met on a bench in a park. Once we sat down, she was sort of acting strange. She in the past had been pretty cool, and today she seemed really anxious. When I tried to understand what was going on, she explained something that I probably should have known beforehand, but didn't. It was March the 30th, and it was 4:15 p.m., and at 5 p.m., all of the Ivy League colleges in the country were going to simultaneously release all of their acceptances and rejections, and students like Shannon all over the country were going to get the news on their phones. Shannon had applied to Princeton and to Penn, and Penn was her dream school. This moment was 45 minutes away where she was going to find out whether that dream had come true or not.
And she says this really dramatic thing. She said, "It feels like everything is depending on this."
Right, like her whole life had been leading up to this moment, and it seems like, okay, you're overdoing this a little bit. But she was the student who had worked tremendously hard in high school. She was at the top of her high school class. She was on her way to becoming the valedictorian. And she wasn't one of those kids for whom, you know, being number one was really easy. She worked tremendously hard. She described staying up till 2 or 3 in the morning every night, making sure her homework was all done perfectly. It gave me this idea of her as this real sort of intellectual in a place where it is hard to be an intellectual, and someone who would fit perfectly at one of these institutions.
And yet, as Paul Tough came to learn in reporting the book, young people like Shannon are almost never admitted to the prestigious schools they want to attend.
You know, these institutions are still dominated by wealthy students with a lot more connections and resources than she had. And so the chance of her getting the opportunity to have that kind of education seemed remote both to me and to her.
For Shannon, this was an incredibly tense moment. In fact, it was the most important moment of her life to that point. And she just needed somebody to share it with.
She explained that she had actually chosen to be with me on that bench for this moment, that I hadn't quite understood when I sat down that this was about to happen. She knew she didn't want to be with family. She didn't want to be with friends from school. She didn't want to be with the people who she thought had such high expectations for her. She said she felt like I was on her side, which I was, but at the same time, I wasn't expecting anything from her. That made me understand that just sort of doing my job as a journalist and asking questions and, you know, not sort of encouraging or comforting too much, but just listening was kind of what she needed.
So they're sitting on that park bench. Shannon keeps checking the time, looking at her phone, waiting to find out if she'd gotten into her dream school. And Paul starts to see the ideas for his book perfectly reflected in her story.
Does the system of higher education work as a meritocracy? Is it fair? Are applications and admissions fair? Does the whole process of being able to change your life, to achieve social mobility through higher education, this idea that's sort of been at the heart of our higher education system for decades, does it still function the way that it used to, both in general and specifically for young people like Shannon?
Paul Tough's new book is a deep exploration of those questions. It's called The Years That Matter Most: How College Makes or Breaks Us. It took him 6 years to write. And one of the things he discovered was that the inequities in the American higher education system started to grow when the country's attitude changed. Tuff says, it used to be we thought of a college education as this collective good, something that whether or not you took advantage of it yourself, it ended up benefiting all of us. But now, he says, our attitude has changed.
I do have a sort of nostalgic feel for an earlier period in higher education. At the same time, it's true that, you know, you go back 100 years or even 70 years, higher education was exclusively for rich kids, right? Yeah. It wasn't even thought of until after World War II as this engine of social mobility. It was just a finishing school for the rich. And it was the GI Bill that really started to change that in the years after World War II, when suddenly all of these working class kids, the children of farmers, the children of factory workers started flooding onto college campuses after coming back from the war. And not only did it change their lives, but it changed for the first time our ideas about what higher education could do and who could succeed there.
It's interesting you mentioned de Tocqueville, who came here and was taking note of American social mobility, which he found to be kind of chaotic and strangely fluid. But in America, the assumption eventually kind of comes to be settled that mobility is dependent on a college degree. And this was the part that was so difficult for some of the students that you were talking about, that there was no room for error in this new system of class mobility. We'll get into the details a bit as we go, but explain what you found about American class mobility, because it's more complicated than a college degree. There's class mobility, there's a college degree. What did you find about that?
So in an earlier era in American history, college was not the way that social mobility worked. It was mostly through entrepreneurialism and hard work. In the mid-19th century, a lot of the people, and they were mostly men, and they were almost exclusively white men, so there were a lot of barriers to many Americans. But there were these ways that through, you know, pluck and hard work and ingenuity, you could, you know, go and pan for gold, or you could, like, start an oil well in Texas, or you could start your own business. There were all of these stories. It was sort of the basic American story, right? Whether it's immigrants or settlers going west, of starting from nothing and using your own hard work and your own great ideas, building a fortune. And college really wasn't a part of that story until the middle of the 20th century. And then as it became more and more of a story, it gradually became kind of the only story.
Yeah.
And so it is now very rare, except for a few exceptions, for someone without a college degree to be able to achieve social mobility and achieve that kind of success. And so the combination of that fact happening and social mobility becoming so intertwined with higher education, and then at the same time higher education becoming so unequally distributed, so that we have these very different systems with different outcomes depending on how selective the institution you go to turns out to be, that combination I think has created for young people like Shannon this feeling that it's an extremely high-stakes game, but it's also a game that's very unfair.
There's this economist you write about in the book at Harvard, really cut his teeth at Stanford, actually. Raj Chetty is his name. He's an expert in mobility, and he uses big data, which he managed to get. It's a good story, actually, where he manages to get from the IRS in exchange for doing work, which is a pretty clever concept. Anyway, what's interesting about Chetty's work is that he sort of comes to this understanding about how all of these complicated dynamics come into play. There's income and there's race and geography. You mentioned how before Chetty, it was difficult to know who was benefiting from going to college. But then this data now opened all of this up. So talk a little bit about the importance of what Chetty is understanding about mobility.
Yeah. So, you know, we've known for a long time that a college degree was valuable. Economists have for a long time been able to measure what they call the college wage premium, which just indicates how much more any individual makes with a college degree than without one. And we've known that for the last couple of decades, the college wage premium has been very high as it's ever been. But it was still very difficult beyond that to kind of disentangle all the different threads and selectivity biases that come into trying to figure out exactly what a college education does for any given person. And what Raj Chetty and his colleagues did when they finally got access to these tax records that were not only present tense tax records, but also went back generations, they could see how your income connected to your parents' income and your grandparents' income and your children's income, and then they could see how different institutions of higher education figured into that. And so someone in the 50s from a particular economic background went to a particular institution, and then they and their children had a certain outcome. Chetty was actually able to figure that out for each individual, and that let him explain for the first time how important selectivity was, that when you do go to one of these institutions that is the most selective, it really makes a difference. Those are the institutions that are most likely to produce graduates that make a lot of money as adults, and that those institutions especially matter for young people like Shannon. That when low-income students are admitted to one of those institutions, they have the same kind of outcomes as high-income students who go to the same institution. And so they come from very different backgrounds, they end up at the same institution, and the gaps between them are almost completely erased in 4 years. In lots of ways, the story that Raj and his colleagues told was a really positive social mobility one. It was like the college works. It really is able to overcome these gaps and to create mobility. But then the other more distressing, more discouraging finding in that Chetty came up with was that when you look at who's going to these institutions, it is not young people like Shannon. You know, at most selective institutions, what Raj Chetty calls the Ivy Plus institutions, mm-hmm. meaning Ivy League colleges and a few other similarly selective ones, students from Shannon's economic class, from the bottom economic quintile, only about 2 or 3% of the student bodies at those institutions are from that economic background.
Elite Ivy League Plus universities are not letting... They're not letting in poor kids in some ways, or at least hardly at all. I mean, for example, how many poor students are there at Princeton?
Well, it depends how you measure poor. And Princeton points to this measure called the Pell percentage, what percentage of their students are eligible for a Pell grant, which is given to students sort of in the bottom 40% to 50% of the economic distribution. And Princeton actually has made strides over the past decade or so to improve their Pell percentage. And in some ways, that's an important undertaking. What is more useful about Raj Chetty's data is that it is more precise. So what Chetty's data shows is that there are very few, but 2.2% at Princeton of the student body in his study came from the bottom quintile. And so, in a class of 1,600, that's something like 35, 40 students. So if you are a student like Shannon and you get to one of those institutions, there just aren't a lot of people who come from similar backgrounds.
And that's true across the board in these Ivy League plus colleges?
There's some variation. So some are 2%, some are 3%, some are 4%. But definitely they're all skewed in similar ways.
It's interesting. It's like there is this... there's this thing they're keeping to themselves. It's reinforcing this kind of hierarchy that seems so archaic, I have to say. It seems like something we would have moved beyond decades ago. And there's this question, are they consciously keeping poor people from their schools? I mean, surely it's more complicated or nuanced than that. But you write that through our current system of higher education, we seem to have constructed this kind of aristocracy in some way.
Yeah, the why part of that question is really hard to answer, and it's hard to get a straight answer because they often don't admit that that's what's going on. They talk about the great Pell percentages. They talk about changes that are happening that will bring better numbers in the years ahead. But I mean, you know, one of the kind of crazy things about this system is that how institutions of higher education, especially highly selective ones, are clearly institutions that are making social divisions and economic divisions worse. And yet the people who tend to run them are like, you know, progressive college types, right? It's not like these are, you know, tobacco executives, you know, who are only focused on the bottom line. And so that's where I feel like the kind of cognitive dissonance in higher education becomes so intense. And I think the way that we fool ourselves and are sometimes fooled by these institutions plays a big role. We just have a hard time talking honestly about what is going on in higher education and how these institutions function. And I think that lack of honesty and lack of transparency on the part of these institutions just perpetuates these problems and perpetuates these gaps.
It seems like such a blunt question, and I know the answers are nuanced, but Why wouldn't an Ivy League plus institution want a poor kid to come to their institution? Why would that be not welcome? What are the incentives at play that, and maybe that's not a fair statement, but it seems like in some ways that's what's playing out.
Yeah, I mean, I would say it's a few institutional priorities. I mean, one is that I think they would say that it's not that they don't want these students to show up. It's that they have so many other slots that they have to fill. So there was one admissions counselor, or admissions director, who said to me, you know, some of these institutions say they're need blind, but they're definitely not wealth blind. So many of their slots go to legacy students, to students who might become donors, to, you know, students with especially high SAT scores, which tend to be high income students, to athletes in you know, certain sports that are dominant in prep schools. So early admission students, all of these forces in college admissions are already pushing them towards taking these affluent students. They feel like they don't have room for anyone else. I think they also genuinely feel like those students can't succeed at their colleges. They feel like, you know, we want to admit them. If they could hack it, we would bring them in. But they have persuaded themselves that these students can't succeed on their campuses. What I see is that these students absolutely can succeed, and that if Princeton or, you know, Yale or Stanford or anywhere else does a little bit more to bring in more of those students and help them succeed more, that they can overcome any sort of early stumbles that sometimes come with those students. But then I think maybe there's a third reason, which is that it's a little bit cultural, too. Mm-hmm. I mean, I think there still is this idea in the minds of those administrators and admissions directors of what an Ivy League student looks like, you know, both literally, physically, but also what their background's like, what their cultural touchstones are like, what their work ethic is like. And I think when they look at low-income students, they feel like this is not who we are. And I think that whether that's subconscious or completely conscious, it works against them admitting those students.
One of the things you write about is this process of getting your kid into an elite school. And it gets us to another great character in the book, a man named Ned Johnson, whom I have to say, well, I was prepared to hate. Because, you know, he's like the best of the best when it comes to these college prep tutors. He charges $400 an hour, and his success rate is amazing. If you're wealthy and you want to get your kid into a really good school and you're in the DC area, call Ned Johnson. And I thought, I love the guy. I have to say, at least the way you portray him, his sense of the system, how it works, but also the way he sort of figured it out, the more abstract way that he looks at all of this. Tell us about Ned Johnson.
Yeah, Ned is great. So yes, I'm with you. You want to believe he's a bad guy, and he is definitely a part of an unfair system. But no, he's great. And it's hard not to like him, and I do like him a lot. I mean, one of the things that was striking to me is during the years that I was reporting on Ned, the College Board, the institution that oversees the SAT, which Ned was teaching his students how to get so much better on, they were undertaking this sort of PR campaign against people like Ned.
Yeah.
People like Ned are really a threat to the continued functioning of the College Board, because if the SAT is a true measure of the sort of inherent academic ability of any given student, you shouldn't be able to get the incredible score jumps that Ned was able to help his affluent students achieve. And so the head of the College Board, this man named David Coleman, spent a lot of time talking about these evil test prep people, these predators, as he put it, that were warping the system with their tricks and their tactics. And, you know, Ned says, listen, I didn't invent the system, dude.
Yeah.
You did. You're the one who has created a test that has such high stakes, and that I don't have that much trouble helping these, you know, high paying students get a lot better at. And in fact, you know, one of the things that it was so heartening for me about Ned is that he thinks the system should change, right?
Yeah.
Like he is making a good living from the inequities in this system. But, you know, whenever he has a chance to talk publicly about it, he says we should not be putting so much pressure on these tests because they are not fair.
Well, one of the things he does, and Johnson seems to understand more than most, is that it really isn't about the test. It's about the way the student sees the test. Talk a little bit about, I don't know if it's a technique or a gimmick, but he gets these students to rethink their, as you say in the book, their basic beliefs about this somehow magical power of the test. He basically takes away that sense of magic.
Yeah, so for the students who show up in Ned's office, they have started with so many advantages already, right? They usually go to private schools, expensive private schools. They have highly educated parents. So, like, it's not like they are starting from scratch when they're doing the math and the reading comprehension that's on the SAT or the ACT. And so his theory, and it seems to bear out, is that why these students are not getting, you know, super high test scores when they come to him doesn't have that much to do with their vocabulary or their reading ability or their understanding of complex algebra. It has to do with their anxiety. Yeah. And the way that the tests are structured and the way that the high-pressure society that these kids live in is structured is it puts all of this weight, all of this pressure on these tests. And Ned is a great scholar of the science of stress. He spends a lot of time trying to understand, you know, stress physiology, stress psychology, how being in a high-pressure situation that you can't control makes you a little bit crazy. And so that is a big part of his solution, that he tries to help his students calm down. He spends a lot of time talking about sleep and mm-hmm. talking about exercise and having a balanced schedule. And partly that he just thinks, like, you'll have a better life if you do all those things. But he also believes that thinking differently about the test will really change how well you do. He teaches students all these little sort of tricks where, you know, if you can just look at a diagram on the test and you can eyeball it, usually what you eyeball is right because they'll never give you a diagram that's completely out of whack. And so if that line AB looks like it's about, you know, 2 and not 3, then try 2. That's a pretty good guess, right?
Right.
And so that's like not a bad strategy, and it might give his students a couple more points on the test. But psychologically, the advantage of helping his students understand these little tricks is that it changes their way of thinking about the test. It goes from them thinking like, oh, this is actually this measure of how good a person I am, how smart I am, how much my, you know, family respects me. Instead, it's like, oh, I get it. It's a game. And there are rules and there are tactics and techniques that are going to help me beat this game. And it works. And once they change into that mindset, whereas this is just a game that some guys, you know, came up with in a room somewhere in New York, and I can outsmart it, that gives you this sense not of, you know, fear and pressure, but of power. Yeah. And when you have that feeling when you go into the test, you're much more likely to do well.
Paul Tough, his book is The Years That Matter Most: How College Makes or Breaks Us. We'll be back in a moment. This is Radio West.
Hey, it's Lee Hale. You know how they say there are certain things you just shouldn't bring up in mixed company? Well, this week on the Preach podcast, we're breaking all the rules.
Sex and God, those are like huge things to be thinking about.
That's Dr. Batsheva Marcus, a feminist Orthodox Jewish sex therapist. We talk about how studying the Talmud led to a study of human sexuality. That's on the Preach podcast. Find it wherever you get your podcasts or at preachpod.org.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today, we're asking the question at the heart of journalist Paul Tough's latest book, Does College Still Work? Tough wanted to know if the American higher education system is actually the ladder to upward mobility we've always thought it was. Well, if you're not in that privileged class of Americans, Tough says it's not. One of the things you write about, this was interesting, is the way the college selection process itself for, you know, when you're a high school kid, how that's changed. And it seems like dramatically over the decades. Students, like in the 60s, for example, when they were making a decision about where they wanted to go to college, a lot of the time that decision was based on, you know, something that was somewhat close to home, schools that were recommended by friends and family. But now, it seems like all that matters are these super hyper-selective, you know, Ivy League plus schools. And that gets us to the importance of the SAT or the ACT scores. Talk a little bit about that, how that has how that selection process has changed so dramatically.
So I found this completely fascinating. This came from the work of an economist at Stanford named Carolyn Hawksby, who has done some remarkable studies of sort of the history of higher education admissions and how it's changed. And you're right. So she was the first one to understand that 40 or 50 years ago, young people were making their decisions based sort of on like idiosyncratic ideas, but largely based on geography, right?
Yeah.
You go to a pretty good college that's somewhere near where you are. And as a result, there was a more balance of different types of students at each institution, you know, like at a high school, right? There's you're going to have your A students and your B students and your C students. The same thing was true at a lot of colleges because they were pulling together their student bodies a lot like high schools did. And then at some point in the 70s and 80s, students began, especially more affluent and especially higher scoring students, they began to change their decision-making process. And gradually, the decision came down to just one fact, which is if I'm a high scoring student, where are the other high scoring students going?
Yeah.
And mostly they were going to the institutions that had been around for a long time and had large endowments and had, you know, good prestigious reputations as well. And so those students started to cluster at those institutions, and those institutions, the admissions department, saw this happening, saw that young people were saying, well, I only want to go if I've got high scores, I only want to go where there are other high scoring students. They started responding by admitting more and more high scoring students, because the more high scoring students you admit, the more who apply, the more people who want to go to your college, the more income, revenue, prestige, all of the things that go along with being a highly sought after college. And so as a result, we now have this very intense clustering of high scoring students at a very few colleges. Those colleges have become much harder to get into. Mm. And every other college has become easier to get into as the most high scoring students have pulled away from those institutions and put all of their focus on the most selective institutions.
There's this story you tell in the book of a young woman named Clara. And her college decision, you know, she comes from a privileged background, and it comes down to these kind of two choices for her. One is the school that she really wants to go to, which is Middlebury, still an elite, you know, liberal arts school. But then it's Yale is the other option, which her family wants her to go to, her parents want her to go to, because that, in some way, they're perceiving as much more prestigious. And so it's an interesting, I don't know if you want to give away the decision that she actually makes, but the decision that she's having to make, talk about that process that she's having to work through, because it's kind of instructive.
Yeah. So I don't want to give away the choice that she makes, but I feel like that decision that she felt like she was trapped in, I think is the feeling that a lot of students from affluent communities feel, which is that they might want to make their decision the way people did, you know, in the 50s or 60s or 70s. Like, this college seems like it's a good fit for me. I want to go there. The people seem happy there. It seems like people who would understand me. There's a lot that I'd like to learn. All of these things that we say we want young people to think about when they're making their college decisions. But the reality is all of the pressures from her family and her school and in lots of ways her culture were saying follow this same algorithm, the same principle that every other student is following, and go to the most selective institution that will admit you. And in her case, a lot of her family pressure was about Yale. And that was really difficult for her to resist. I think she just felt like what I want is maybe not the way that I'm allowed to make this decision. And I think there's a lot of other young people who have the same sort of feeling, the same sort of pressure.
Tell us about Kim in Taylorsville, North Carolina. She also has a decision. I mean, in her heart of hearts, she dreams of going to Cornell. But then there's Clemson, which is nearby. And this brings into focus another part of this story, which is so interesting to me, the dynamics of culture and family and the effect they have on the decisions of young students.
Yeah, so I originally met Kim through her school. She lived in a town called Taylorsville, a small town in western North Carolina, just sort of in the foothills of the Appalachian Mountains, a community that is, you know, very working class, not a lot of money, not a lot of economic prosperity there right now. And so I met her in her junior year and sort of followed her through her senior year. And what struck me as I talked to her was that her decisions about college were all impossible to disentangle from her feelings about her family and her family's feelings about her. So I would, you know, go to her, go hang out with her or talk to her on the phone and like want to talk. Start off, we'd be ostensibly going to talk about college. And we always ended up talking about family. Mm-hmm. And that was crucial to her decision. And in some ways, she was this example of a phenomenon that Carolyn Hawksbee describes. So when this clustering started to happen, Carolyn Hawksbee realized that it was really only happening among affluent high-scoring students. It was affluent high-scoring students like Clara who were continually making the decision to go to the most exclusive, most selective institution that would admit them. And students like Kim, who came from more low-income backgrounds, were continuing to make more idiosyncratic decisions. Mm-hmm. They didn't feel the same sort of pressure. And in fact, they felt lots of pressure in the opposite direction. And so with Kim and her family, you know, her family was saying, you shouldn't go to college. You certainly shouldn't go to a expensive, faraway college. You should just join the Marines. We're not going to pay for college. They were doing everything she felt to make it as difficult as possible for her to succeed. And what struck me, you know, following her through her senior year of high school and the beginning of college was just how painful that was for mm-hmm. her. You know, quite aside from all of the economic questions of where she could get in and how she could pay for it and whether it was going to be worthwhile, it was just hard to be in that situation and feel like you're trying to change your life on your own and that so much of your family and culture is trying to pull you in the opposite direction. Yeah.
Well, it also gets us to the part of the story you tell where you get this sense that we should be able to fix this for low-income students. If we just get them information, get them these packets and tell them that, look, your family doesn't know anything about what it would be like to try to get into Stanford or Harvard or any other really elite school. So and that was seemed to be one of the things that was holding them back. That was the furthest thing from their minds, from their family's minds. It just wasn't part of their culture. And so there was this part of the story that you tell was this idea that if we just get low-income students packets of information, their lives will be turned around. But it doesn't exactly work out that way. Say something about this part of the story.
Yeah, so this goes back to another study done by this economist, Carolyn Hawksbee, where she and a colleague, Sarah Turner from the University of Virginia, figured out that when they set information packets to students like Kim telling them, here are the kind of colleges that your test scores and your grades will likely get you admission to. And if you do get admission, here's the kind of financial aid packets that you can get. They offered fee waivers so that these students could apply to these selective colleges without having to pay an application fee. And the initial results were that that experiment was working. It was moving the needle. It was changing the behavior of some students. When the College Board, the institution that oversees the SAT, then tried to replicate that at a larger scale and over many years, there was not a big impact. The way that the College Board did it makes it hard to tell exactly what went wrong, what didn't work, and there's still a lot of questions about that. But having spent time with Kim and her family, I felt like I had a pretty good guess at some of the problem, which is just that it's really not just about information. I mean, there are certainly some high school students, especially in rural communities like Kim's, who just have no clue about how college works, and their high schools and their high school guidance systems are not set up to give them the kind of information they need. So more and better information would certainly be a big help. But I think there's both the sort of the cultural family aspects that make it hard for those students to make those decisions. And also, you know, on the other end, going back to what we were talking about before, those institutions may want to believe that they're dying to let in students like Kim, but there are a lot of indications that they're really not. And so my suspicion is that, you know, even if Kim had followed more of a path like Shannon and applied to the most exclusive schools that she could, a lot of them would not have chosen to admit her.
Mm. I want to ask you about Kiki Gilbert, another great story in the book. Through all of this work, Kiki manages to get to Princeton despite all these really big obstacles. And you mentioned how she was consumed with this sense of doubt, not that she doubted herself, but that everyone else doubted her. And I wanted to talk about this part, which is the question of, as the chapter heading in your book puts it, fitting in once they get there. Talk a little bit about the story of Kiki and some of these other first-generation students. When they actually get into college, it's like they're grateful to be there, but it's I think, as you put it, emotionally exhausting for a lot of them.
Yeah, it certainly was for Kiki. And so a little background on her. So she's an African-American student. I met her sort of at the end of her junior year of high school. She was going to school in North Carolina, in Charlotte. But her life up to that point had been pretty chaotic, and her family was complicated and moved around a whole lot. So she had been in a different school every year until the last few years of high school. And she was and is a brilliant student, very hardworking, but had a really challenging family history in lots of ways, and very little money in her family at all. And so she got into Princeton, and there were a couple things that happened. One is, yeah, she in some ways, she's a very confident student, a very confident person. She sort of needed this confidence and this inner drive in order to overcome all of the obstacles that life had put in her way. And yet, when she arrived at Princeton and found herself in this community, she was a philosophy major, and you know, almost everyone else in her program was white and was wealthy. Her confidence started to crumble. She felt like everyone else was judging her, that they could see certainly the color of her skin, but they could also see, you know, she would talk about how they could see my hair, they could see my clothes. I just look different than what a philosopher at Princeton looks like. And she was persuaded that they were all judging her. And so, and she became very attuned to sort of cues and clues and slights that suggested that everyone else did not want her to be there.
It gets us to the research of this sociologist at Harvard, Anthony Jack, who, as you put it in the book, he sort of explores the lives of these first-generation students like Kiki and their experiences at these elite universities. You call Anthony Jack a born noticer, has an eye, you say, for these status clues. Talk a little bit about what he's noticing and what he's studying and what he sees.
Yeah, he's an amazing scholar, has his own book that came out a few months ago called The Privileged Poor that I'd recommend to anybody. He himself was a first-generation student, came from a low-income community in Miami and ended up at Amherst, and was himself one of the few low-income students, African-American students, at a mostly white, privileged campus. And First of all, he just noticed a lot what Kiki noticed, that when you are in that situation, you often feel like an outsider. You can't figure out the customs of the place. There are institutional facts that just sort of financially make it difficult for you to survive and succeed. One of the things that he wrote about in his book was that so many of these elite campuses over spring break shut down their dining halls because most students are going home. But the students who don't go home are the low-income students, the first-generation students who suddenly for a week or two don't have anything to eat. And that's not only sort of a very important financial, physical problem. It's also a sign that this institution doesn't really take me and my concerns seriously.
Yeah. And not all of these alienating experiences were about students of color. You write about one white student from a rural farming town who was seeing some of the other students buying lobsters to cook for dinner when, like, there's all this free food in the dining hall. It made no sense to them. But you saw that the cultural disconnect was there.
Yeah. He does lots of interviews with lots of students and gets at these sort of nuanced facts of what they notice, what these students notice about the craziness of suddenly being plunged into a community like a lot of these highly selective colleges that is just so affluent, such an example of sort of concentrated affluence.
So Tony Jack studies this for about 10 years, and he comes up with these two distinct categories of low-income students of color, the privileged poor and the doubly disadvantaged. Say a little bit about that, because the distinction here surprised me. I wasn't ready for that.
Yeah. So I think the sort of broad strokes that he's noticed, that it's hard being a low-income student on a exclusive campus, other people have reported. But his innovation, his real discovery was that what happens to you in high school if you're a low-income student plays a big role in what happens to you in college. And because of the way selective college admissions works, when those colleges do want to select low-income students, especially low-income students of color, the first place they look is not the, you know, big public high schools that admit, that enroll and educate most low-income students of color. It is private schools, prep schools, where there is usually a small number of students who were admitted on scholarship, sometimes in these sort of intensive preparatory programs. And those are the students who are much more likely to be admitted to an Ivy League institution. And what Tony Jack discovered is that when low-income students do have that background, spending a few years at a prep school before getting to a highly selective college, the culture shock is much less intense because they've already gone through it, right?
Yeah.
They had their culture shock at age 14 when they started freshman year at a boarding school. And so by the time they get to this highly selective institution, they're used to the, you know, kids who are buying lobsters when there's lots of food in the dining hall. But it is everybody else, the sort of more normal, normative experience of being a low-income student, going to a normal, you know, low-income public high school, excelling there, and then getting selected to a highly selective college. You're having your culture shock now at 18 when you show up on campus. And that's just a lot harder for a whole lot of reasons. Partly, I think, you're just older, right? So your personality is more set. Partly, you're under enormous other sorts of pressure when you are starting freshman year. You're just trying to keep up academically. And also, I think there is a way that high schools and prep schools in particular, their ethos is like, we are going to shape and mold the characters of our students. And so that sort of painful culture shock that happens at the beginning of freshman year of high school, it's like the institution knows how to do that, how to make sure you know how to, you know, sit and order in a French restaurant and talk in class. But colleges have always taken more of a hands-off approach, right? It's part of the basic ethos of college that we're not going to meddle. We're going to let our students make their own mistakes. And there's something obviously good about that. Independence is an important part of what college is. But it also means that these young people who are experiencing culture shock at the beginning of freshman year of college often feel abandoned and alone. There's nobody to sort of help them, support them, guide them through this process. And as a result, their college years, Tony Jack found, are much harder, much more stressful.
I want to come back to Kiki Gilbert for a moment, because the story that you tell about her coming home for Thanksgiving that I think is really interesting, because I've heard you talk about how in a lot of ways the larger story is about how we tell our own story and our own sort of sense of identity. And this story about her coming home, I mean, you know, she's really torn in some ways. She has this one cultural experience at this elite institution. And then she goes back home, and the question is, where do I fit in all of this? Where am I? Would you tell a little bit about this moment when she goes back for Thanksgiving?
Yeah, so Kiki is a remarkable person, was a remarkable subject to get a chance to spend time with her and through her eyes try to understand this, going through this culture shock on a campus. And Kiki had described to me how during her high school years she had found a way to sort of psychologically distance herself from her family, because a lot of what they were living through at the time was extremely difficult. They spent a year living in a motel, essentially homeless, and it was the pressure that she was under, the just sort of physical difficulties of that life were remarkable and sad to hear about and to understand. But she sort of developed this psychological strategy, which was this kind of distancing, which was telling herself, this is my family in some ways, but it's also not entirely me. I am going to be somewhere else. And so she could kind of pull herself out of her situation mentally. And when she gets home for Thanksgiving to this new home where her family is living, and it was the first time she'd seen them in months, she was suddenly plunged back into the chaos of her family. And she had lost that sort of those armaments that had protected her from that experience in the past. And she suddenly was, you know, forced to understand this is me, or at least it's part of my experience. And that gap between what this, you know, my family is experiencing, these people that I love and that you know have shaped me and who I feel so connected to, this experience that's happening in this house over Thanksgiving dinner and what's happening an hour down the road at Princeton, I am never going to be able to fully bridge that divide. And that, I think, was just painful for her on an emotional level, almost sort of an existential level, in terms of trying to understand like who she was, where she had come from, where she was going. It created these dilemmas for her that I think she's still struggling to solve.
I want to ask you about, you were referring earlier to the GI Bill, and I wanted you to say something about that. And then the person you talked to, this another great character in the story, a man by the name of Patrick Fay, whom you meet in Connecticut. Talk a little bit about Patrick Fay's story, because it's a good one.
So, you know, in some ways, Patrick Fay was a lot like other students that I had met. He's a lot like Shannon. You know, he was the child of immigrants. He came from a sort of low-income, working-class family and a community where nobody really went to college. But what was different about him and Shannon is that she was, you know, 17, 18 when I was talking with her, and he was 93 when I was talking to him. And the reason that I was talking to him was that he was a veteran. He is a veteran of World War II, and he went to college on the GI Bill. And the GI Bill was, I think, this sort of central moment where things shifted in terms of our understanding of higher education in this country. And I wanted to understand, I'd read a lot about it, but I wanted to understand from his perspective what it was like to be a part of that moment and that movement. So he described growing up in this working class community. His dad was a factory worker and then a dock worker. You know, their family didn't have a lot of money. He was really an ambitious student, but at that point, you know, you just didn't go to college unless you were part of the upper class, and his family was definitely not. And yet then he goes off to World War II and fights and is heroic and is shot by a German sniper in the Battle of the Bulge and helps liberate Berlin from the Nazis, and then comes home. And he describes this moment where he's in a tent with a lot of other GIs, sort of mustering out right at the end of the war before going back to his community in Boston. And they say, hey, there's this thing that happened. We've passed a GI Bill and the government will pay for 4 years of your education. And this was exactly the opportunity that he had been looking for. He spent 4 years going to Northeastern, studied chemistry, got a master's, got a good job working for the same corporation for the next several decades, got married. But when I looked then into his family's life, so he had six kids, they all went to college, they all went to graduate school, he had lots of grandkids, he went to every single one of their college graduations. Now he's got great grandkids, and he said, you know, I'm not going to be there for their graduations, but I know they're all going to be fine. And so when he looked back at his family's history, you know, his grandfather was a farmer in Ireland, father was a factory worker, his kids and grandkids and great grandkids are all comfortable and affluent and well educated, and he was sort of the hinge in his family's story, and the GI Bill was the hinge in his story. And what he helped me understand is that it was this hinge in the country's story as well, that it wasn't just him. There were lots of other, millions of other GIs who were having that experience, and the change that happened in their lives and their families' lives and their communities' lives had ripple effects that went out and transformed the American economy. This group of former GIs became the great American middle class that powered the post-war economic boom. And their experiences really changed the national idea of what college could be, from changing from this force that was just sort of, right, as I said, the finishing school for the rich, into this real process of mobility and opportunity and change. And that, I think, created this idea, not just in his life, but in lots of people's lives, that college could do something different. And those echoes, I think, are what we've lost now as we think about what higher education can be. There was this moment where we saw it as this thing that could really change the lives of young people. And it was, and that we, I think, Americans saw it as our responsibility to make that happen, that in contributing to Patrick Fay's education, we were contributing to the betterment of our country as a whole. And I think when we think about, say, Shannon's education, we're less committed now to making that a public good instead of just a private good.
There's a moment I found particularly sad in the book. It's at the end of that section with Shannon Torres from West Harlem, who's waiting to find out if she gets into Princeton or Penn. And you mentioned that through her experience, and again, we won't give it away, but you said in the book that Shannon would never entirely get back her heartfelt faith that in the American system of higher education, like she had lost this kind of innocence. And I found that really sad, I have to say.
Yeah, I mean, I feel like we need to tell readers that the end of her story is not a sad one. But I do think that there was something sad in it. And it took me a long time to try to understand from her why what turned out to be pretty happy news did not feel like the perfect end to her story. Yeah. And I think it was that there was something about that afternoon that we spent together on the bench that made her, I mean, she you know, in some ways, she was like the most hopeful, the most optimistic student who I met. She really believed in higher education as this meritocracy, as this font of social mobility, and the way that decision played out in her life just made her feel like, oh, I get it. It's kind of a game. It's kind of a roll of the dice. And I feel like any system of social mobility that is based on luck, that is based on chance, whether that's, you know, the luck of who your parents are and where you're born, or the luck of what any college admissions officer feels when they look at your application on any given day, that is not a system that really inspires a lot of faith, either on the part of young people like Shannon or on the part of the rest of us.
Paul Tough. His new book is The Years That Matter Most, How College Makes or Breaks Us. Radio West is a production of KUER. Don't forget to subscribe to our podcast if you haven't already. You can visit radiowest.org to do that, or just search for us on any of the podcast apps. The program is produced by Tim Slover and Benjamin Bombard. Christy Miners is our executive producer. I'm Doug Fabrizio.